This Texas Matters podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how Laredo is dealing with the overflow of asylum-seeking children from Central America. And it's a cult favorite novel with Texas roots about the love of learning and teaching. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The situation on the border isn't getting any better. The flow of asylum seekers from a destabilized Central America is running into a politically charged response from a federal government that's not focused on humanitarian aid. While the debate churns about the appropriateness of calling the detention facilities concentration camps, eyewitness accounts of the conditions in some locations are without parallel. Recent reports from detention facilities near Clint, Texas, outside of El Paso, described hundreds of young people being contained in inhumane conditions. The reporting tells of about 250 infants, children, and teens locked up for weeks without adequate food, water, and sanitation. Warren Benford is part of the inspection team that witnessed the conditions at Clint, Texas.
We saw hundreds of children being warehoused in unsanitary and unhealthy conditions. We saw very young children, from infants. We saw toddlers, preschoolers, school-age children, tweens, adolescents. We saw child mothers with babies. They were dirty. They were hungry. Many of them had been sleeping on the floor. They described being kept in cells of 25, 30, 50, 100 children. One child said that when he first arrived, he was put into a warehouse with 300 other children. We are seeing a flu outbreak there. On Wednesday, a lice outbreak was reported. The children described losing a lice comb when a lice comb was passed around for them to, brush their hair and brush each other's hair. And when one of the combs was lost, the children said that the guards came in, got mad at them, took away their blankets, took away their sleeping mats, and told them that they could not sleep on their mats or their beds that night. They'd have to sleep on the concrete floor as punishment. In almost all the rooms, every child that we talked to described that there are children who are sleeping on the concrete floors on a regular basis. They've described infants having to sleep on concrete floors. Some of the young children have no one to take care of them. And so they, the older children who are sometimes 7 or 8 years old themselves, or, tweens or teenagers, are asked to take care of the children or choose to take care of the younger children themselves because they're 2, 3, 4 years old and have no one to care for them. One of the child described that she's been taking care of a little girl who has become so attached to her that she calls the older girl taking care of her mama. The guards are not able to care for these children. These facilities are not for children. The children are being fed the same instant food all day, every day. It's the same meal, instant oatmeal for breakfast, a cookie and Kool-Aid. At lunch, they're being fed an instant cup of soup, a cookie and Kool-Aid. And then in the evening, they're being fed a microwave burrito in a plastic wrapper and a cookie and Kool-Aid. They're getting almost no nutrition. We have child mothers there who are trying to nurse their babies. They can't produce enough milk, and so their children are going hungry. When this happened, the guards gave them the same food, this highly processed chemical food that's not even suitable for adults, let alone children, brought that for, an infant toddler who was going hungry because his mom couldn't produce enough milk because she's not being given enough to eat. So we're seeing sick children, we're seeing hungry children, we're seeing dirty children. They're described not being given showers, hardly ever, if ever. You know, one of the first girls that we interviewed said that she had not been given a shower for the first 3 weeks that she was there until just before our arrival. And remember that the government knew that we were coming. They knew that we were coming to this region 3 weeks ago. They knew that we were coming to this facility last week. And when we walked in, the children still hadn't been, many of them had not been bathed. They were in dirty clothes and were hungry. The children were falling asleep sometimes during interviews. The children were often crying because they were so sad about the conditions that they've been kept in. And most importantly, the fact that almost all of them have been separated from family members. Some of them had been separated from parents. Others had been separated from an older sibling or an aunt or a grandma. Some of the children were in the facility with a sibling, and they're supposed to be keeping family units together, but they had separated the siblings. Some of the children described being separated by the, you know, from their sibling by a chain link fence, and that trying to talk through the chain link fence was the only opportunity they had to see their sibling. And one of them described the guard yelling at them when they tried to talk to their sibling. It's just a horrific situation, and there are hundreds of children in this facility that's not meant for children at all. The Border Patrol agents are saying that they feel badly for these children, that the children don't belong there, that they're not supposed to be there, you know, at most for more than a few hours, or, you know, 72 hours is the limit, that they're supposed to be kept there at the maximum, and that basically, you know, the government's coming to pick up these kids and put them where they belong, which ultimately is with their families. But in the process that has been set up by our government, they're supposed to go to an ORR facility, and the reunification effort started there, but these kids are not being transferred to an ORR facility quickly enough, and it's creating this crisis.
What's the breakdown?
The breakdown is that we're not putting these kids with their families, that we're taking them away from their families. Almost all the children that we encountered came across with a family, with an adult family member who could care for them. They were separated, forcibly separated from the family members, and then they are not being placed with other family members in the United States. That almost every child had, you know, their mother's telephone number, you know, in their pocket, or the older children had memorized it. Really, what we need to be doing is, you know, not putting them through this process where they go to ORR, and normally children are only in ORR for a couple of weeks, you know, to usually, you know, a few days, or at most, you know, just under 3 weeks. And basically what we're seeing in our ORR facilities is children who have been kept there for 9 months or longer, and that's creating a backlog in the system. We are being told that part of the problem that we're seeing is that administration separated so many children last year that they don't have enough time to process all the background checks on the parents and family members as quickly as they used to. And so part of this is, we're told, background check capacity. But, you know, my fear is that this is, and the administration's policy documents indicate that this is an intentional policy decision to create deterrence. That, you know, if these families and children are handled in this way, that we will stop seeing the exodus from Central America. Remember that this is nowhere near the highest number of, you know, people coming to the United States that we've seen over the last 40 years. But what's different about it is that, you know, we are separating children from their families and creating a large population of children who are being detained in inhumane conditions because of that separation and the fact that we're not placing these children with their families in the United States quickly enough.
Do you think if most Americans were able to witness what you saw and what you experienced, what would their reaction be?
I think that they would get on airplanes and be outside this facility and demanding that these children be let go, you know, that they would have the same instincts that I do, you know, as a mother and as a human being, which is, you know, to take these children myself to the airport, get on a plane and get these kids to their mom or dad or, you know, their aunt, their uncle, their grandmother and get them home, get them to some place where they're safe and loved and well cared for.
Warren Binford is part of the team that inspected the conditions at the Border Patrol's holding facility near Clint, Texas. She is an internationally recognized children's rights scholar and advocate. She is a professor of law and serves as the director of the clinical law program at Willamette University. Communities are responding along the Texas-Mexico border, trying to provide relief and humane treatment for the asylum seekers. Laredo's Holding Institute has been around since the late 1800s. It started out as a school for Mexican-American children who weren't allowed in Texas public schools. Now it's a community center and a shelter for migrants from Central America. Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leanos Jr. reports that it's taking on migrants from communities all along the Texas-Mexico border that have run out of space.
A Honduran woman is sitting with her young son outside the Holding Institute as the sun begins to set. The institute takes up an entire block in downtown Laredo and is filled with families just like hers. She's in an area where kids can play basketball or have some fun on the playground and swing sets. She says her dream has always been to find the best life for her son and didn't want anything bad to happen to him back home. The woman didn't want her name being used in fear that speaking out will hurt her claim for asylum. She says after they crossed the Rio Grande, they turned themselves over to Border Patrol agents and were sent to a processing center, then transferred to another facility. After being fully processed, she and her son were sent to a local church in Laredo. But the church was full, so they ended up at the Holding Institute instead. She says part of her did achieve her dream and part of her didn't, and that it's not easy. The woman says now they're waiting to travel to the Northeast, where they have family, and will wait for their day in immigration court. She says during their journey to get here, she lost her husband in Monterrey, and she hasn't heard from him in more than 2 weeks. Inside the Holding Institute, a man from Central America begins to play his guitar to a room full of migrants who have just arrived. Families with their children make their way to tables where volunteers will bring them food. Some of the asylum seekers will stay here for a couple of hours, while others will stay here for several days. They're all heading to destinations across the country to wait for their day in immigration court. Michael Smith is the executive director of the institute and says they've been helping migrants for a while now, about 50 people per week, but recently that number quadrupled.
About a month ago that changed because of all the massive amounts of people that are in the valley, El Paso. We started to receive about 200 people a day. We're getting people from detention centers. We're getting people from the ports of entry. We're getting people that are released directly from ICE or CBP.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection has also sent migrants to other cities and states via bus and aircraft to relieve regions like El Paso and the Rio Grande Valley, which are at the forefront of the influx. Smith says the Holding Institute didn't get much of an advance notice from CBP.
We had a meeting on Thursday. The large numbers began Friday, the next day.
Smith says the institute has struggled with basic things like paying the rent and keeping the power on, and he's had to use his own money to pay for things like medical supplies. Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar represents Laredo. He added language to an appropriations bill that would make it easier for organizations like the Holding Institute to be reimbursed by the federal government for their work with migrants.
I'm hoping where now we will set aside $30 million a year that will then the cities, the counties, and the nonprofits can apply directly for reimbursement for food, diapers, transportation.
Cuellar pushed to make money available for reimbursement during the last migrant influx in 2014. He says money went to the state of Texas and entities had to ask the state for reimbursement. Cuellar says many local communities and nonprofits never received any money, and he wants to make sure that doesn't happen this time around. That idea has bipartisan support and is making its way through both the House and the Senate. Michael Smith of the Holding Institute says he appreciates the effort to help get organizations like his reimbursed. And regardless of whether he sees any money this time, he's going to continue helping migrants in need. In Laredo, I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr.
The novel Stoner was a critical but not a popular success when it was first published in 1965. Rediscovered in the early 2000s, it's gone on to become an international bestseller and a celebrated cult classic. Many have called it the perfect work, a quintessential American novel. Steve Almond has long understood the allure of this novel and why it endures six decades later. He's written a book about the novel and uses his analysis to discuss his own story as a writer, teacher, father, and husband. His book underscores the ways in which literature guides us to an understanding of the interlife that we each possess and must be attentive to as a balm against the distractions of a social media selfie world. Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides spoke to Steve Almond about his book, William Stoner and the Battle for the Inner Life.
Stoner is a book about a kid from a farm who encounters literature in college unexpectedly, right? He's just supposed to go to university to learn how to save the family farm, learn agricultural techniques. And there he is in a required English course, and, you know, hears a Shakespearean sonnet, and suddenly his soul wakes up, and he can feel the blood flowing through his arteries, and he looks around at the other students, and he can see the down on their cheeks as the light slants in on them from the window, and he's like, the world wakes up. And I think anybody who's a writer or a serious reader, and writers, of course, are just jealous readers, has a similar experience in the portal of their past where literature wakes them up. It connects them to their inner life, and suddenly they start paying attention in a way that they haven't before. And that was what was going on when I first encountered Stoner, which was in grad school. And, you know, it was recommended to me at the end of a drunken party, and, this, you know, you got to read this book. And that is how people are. They become apostles for this book, because those of us who are lovers of literature, writers, teachers, have a similar story in our past where literature has brought us alive in a way, has allowed us to reach feelings that we couldn't reach any other way. And once you have that experience, it's really ecstatic and infectious, and you want to, you know, pass that book along to the next person. So that was what initially drew me to Stoner. And it was also such a strange and unusual book because it was really about the inner life. The basic and, I believe, very revolutionary message of the book was, look, it's not about, what matters isn't the quality of a particular life, it's the attention that is paid to a life. If you are plugged in and paying attention to what is happening inside you emotionally and psychologically, every single human being is living a remarkably dramatic, ecstatic, remarkable, heartbreaking, beautiful life. And I think we have gotten, especially in this moment, lost in the idea that our job is to win attention from the world. That's not our job. Mm-hmm. Our job is to bear witness to our own lives. And that's what Stoner taught me, and it was a lesson that I had never thought to learn, and the book did it remarkably. I mean, that this book is relentless. You simply cannot escape from what William Stoner is experiencing, because it's also crafted in a way that at every pivotal moment in his life where his inner life is in upheaval, the narrative slows down, and he is forced to feel the full human measure of what he's going through.
I mean, it's a love story, but it's not. It's an academic, you know, campus novel, but not really. It's a war novel, but no.
Yep.
You know, it's really difficult to explain. But this idea of the inner life that you've hit on is kind of it. I mean, it's so yep. abstract, but it's kind of the way into trying to explain this book to somebody.
Yeah, I don't think. I mean, interestingly, I understand what you mean, and you use the word ineffable. There is something that's difficult to explain, because you can't hang your hat on the traditional conception of what makes a life worth documenting. The idea that you gain power, that you're ambitious, that you're ruthless, that you're violent, that you're lust-driven and lawless. That's not, this is a book about that announces on in the first paragraph, this is the story of a man who was forgotten by everybody in his own lifetime. He didn't go and do great things. He wasn't a famous soldier or a lover or a, you know, captain of industry. And you're therefore then, right from the beginning, forced to say, so why am I reading? Why does he matter? And the answer is because every single one of us has an incredibly, just simply by virtue of being a human being born into this species, and maybe alone in the universe, we have a consciousness. We have a set of desires, we have a set of fears and anxieties, and we're able to understand and bear witness to them, even though that's a painful thing to do. It couldn't be, I know you're using the word abstract, but actually it's super obvious, and everybody knows that inside of themselves, in the kingdom of their own privacy, not what they're putting out on Facebook or social media, but the stuff they tuck beneath their pillow at night, the stuff that keeps them up at 3 a.m., is a deep concern about whether there's meaning in their life, whether they're doing good work in the world, whether they're honoring their relationships, suffering losses, facing death, you know, betrayal, being unable to take care of people in their life who they wish to take care of, engineering disasters in their marriages or their romantic relationships or their friendships or their professional lives. We're utterly consumed with basically whether we're doing okay and whether our lives have meaning. But we don't talk about it because I think, frankly, consumer culture wants to keep us away from that. They want to convince us that some set of products is going to kind of assuage our doubt. It's this sort of habit trail we're on where consumer culture is constantly arousing our doubt and shame and anxiety so that they can try to sell us a product or a spectacle that will get rid of that stuff. And it never works. It's futile. But what, for me anyway, what I believe is literature and art is created as a kind of productive form of bewilderment, a place where we don't feel alone in that 3 a.m. set of doubts and anxieties and desires that we all carry around as a basic part of the human arrangement.
You started writing about Stoner and pressing this book into people's hands and assigning it in your classes and publishing articles about it. I mean, long years before the 2016 election. And while I feel like the catalyst for writing a paean to a book like this would be precisely what you've written and what is going into the world next, you know, in the next few days. I also believe that in this battle for the inner life, I mean, it's a bloody war. The stakes are higher today in 2019 than they've ever been.
Oh, gosh. I mean, look, I try to explain to people, this is a revolutionary book, because what this book is really saying is, if we lose touch with our inner life, a bunch of algorithms, or if we put our inner lives on display, right, on social media and out there on the internet, a bunch of algorithms are going to use that inner life, our private sets of fears and desires and anxieties, to either try to sell us products or, as we saw from the last election, to poke at the primal negative emotions that turn us against each other. If we turn away from ourselves, really in the hands of demagogues and madmen and bad political actors, that's a moment we become susceptible to being turned against each other. And I think there's a direct link to that. You know, this book, I mean, it sounds crazy to say that, but I feel like it's a profoundly moral and political book. And it's saying the moment you turn away from the inner life, somebody is going to manipulate. You become susceptible to the kind of manipulation that we're now seeing. You know, they have figured out the way Cambridge Analytica and all the rest have figured out, hey, if we can get a hold of people's inner lives, we can actually get into the inner sanctum of how they think and feel, then we can start to manipulate that to make a sale or to push a political agenda that aggregates power amongst, you know, sort of the wealthy and the ill-intentioned. And that is the story of our political discourse right now. Mm-hmm. People are turned against each other because they've turned away from themselves.
The chapter on teaching, I think, is, it's actually, I mean, I'm a teacher, so I mean, I was really into that chapter, but I think it's instructive for everyone because even if you're not a teacher, you've been a student, you've felt strongly right, one way or another about teachers, you're a parent of a student. I read the Chronicle of Higher Ed, and I read nonfiction and fiction all about teaching all the time, but I don't think I've ever felt like anyone nailed what this vocation is all about like you have. And it was Stoner, this book, this character, who helped you find your way to these discoveries. Not all of them are flattering about yourself, but they're so honest. And if people are honest about this profession, I think this chapter is so completely resonant.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. I mean, look, Stoner was all I'm doing is echoing what Stoner's trying to say, which is, look, this guy has a by most accounts, an obscure and very unhappy life, right? His marriage is a disaster. His academic career doesn't go anywhere. But the one thing that redeems him, that gives his life meaning, is that he loves teaching. That he believes that the transmission of attention and love through a study of the language, and it could be the study of any discipline, is a sacred and holy endeavor. And he's right. It is. And every teacher knows that. That at the bottom of what they're doing in a classroom is trying to wake their students up in the way that Stoner was woken up, and in the way that every teacher has a story of being woken up in that way. And that's like this thing of saying, your job could not be more important. You're trying to rescue people from an unexamined life, from just skirting over the surface of it. And in some cases, Stoner himself is a guy who's rescued by education. He's a kid who was going to be left behind and forced to live in kind of a life of agricultural subsistence. And of, you know, the way that the life on the farm is described, there's no discussion, there's no sense of wonder or imagination, and that's what teachers are trying to awaken. You know, I oftentimes joke when I'm talking with, I don't know, you know, reading or whatever, like, in my political platform, teachers get paid $1 million a year, and every CEO in America has to buy their own damn office supplies. Like, our values are so skewed. It is the most sacred job that we could have is educating young people in whatever way. These young, impressionable minds who are going to take, they're going to inhabit the planet from us. And nothing could be more sacred. And that, I don't know a single teacher who isn't an incredibly fierce idealist at the bottom of it. Because they walk into a classroom every day thinking, can I break through? Can I wake a kid up? Can I get a kid excited about the world of knowledge? Can I get them to morally imagine what it's like to be somebody else? To recognize that they could be the next great scientist, or they could be the next, you know, great doctor or great writer or whatever it is. And that's profound. It's an act there. What we're trying to do is transmit love. And it sounds weird and corny, but that's what it is. That's what it's about. And anybody like you who's a teacher knows that. Like, you work so hard to try to reach, especially the students who are hard to reach. And lots of the times you're not successful, at least I'm not successful. But that doesn't mean that you aren't trying to do that. And I think teaching gets written off as something that's just vocational, a part-time job, you get summers off, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, what are you talking about? These people are the heroes. Some teacher who's working in St. Louis or Cleveland and in the public school system, they should be paid $1 million for what they're walking into and what they're trying to do. It's a miracle if they can reach a student and you know, get a student alive in a way that they weren't before. What could be more important on earth?
What would you say to John Williams if you could?
Just like, thank you. Can you please teach me how to do that? That's about it. You know, obviously he might read this book, or maybe, you know, his kids or his surviving widow and might have its quarrels, but basically what I'm saying is, like, this guy wrote an amazing book that just should be part of the canon, that should be read by everybody, and not everybody's going to find this book. It's going to remain kind of a cult classic. It's a big bestseller in Europe for whatever crazy set of reasons that I speculate about, but I don't expect it to become one of those books that is on all the syllabi and all that stuff. It's going to have a different life, and frankly, a lot more like William Stoner himself, mm-hmm. where he makes a profound impact on a small number of people. And that, frankly, is the cosmic story of all of our lives. I mean, there you are in Texas teaching your students and so devoted to the mission that you're kind of brought to tears when you think about what you're trying to do. And you are making a profound impact, but you'll never hear about most of it. And, you know, from a cosmic perspective, we have this brief flickering span on Earth. And our job is to just love as hard as we can and pay attention and recognize that the most profound experiences we're going to have are really private, dignified interactions with people who are very close to us. And that's what we have to try to honor.
Steve Almond is the author of William Stoner and the Battle for the Inner Life, as published by IG Publishing. He spoke with Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website, tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.